Welcome to episode 137 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark Abell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, a family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm Gary Ferencik, a general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. I just spent the last 4 days, I took my mom to Lake Gaston to visit my sister, where we had 4 days of good food, great family time, card playing, adult beverages and the like. And the drive back, I just arrived back here at my mother's place here in Maryland an hour ago. It took 2 hours to drive the last 30 miles. So if I'm a little snarkier or a little more pissy than usual, please forgive me and take that into account.
Well, I remembered we were doing a podcast about 20 minutes away from my house on a bike about half an hour ago. So that's why I'm glad the audience can't see me. That's all I can say. So on this podcast, we highlight poems. If you want all of the poems, you can subscribe to Essential Evidence. And we just launched yesterday our brand new facelifted, much improved site. It's a great experience on your phone as well as on your laptop. You can get that with over 800 disease and symptom chapters, thousands of interactive decision support tools. Check it all out at essentialevidenceplus.com. We're really proud of that update. Spent a lot of time working on it. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can also get CME credit from the IAFP. Go to IAFP.com and click on their education webpage. This week, we're going to discuss amoxicillin and rash in kids with mono, hearing aids and cognition in the elderly, stem cell injections and knee osteoarthritis, and non-pharmacologic approaches to preventing type 2 diabetes. Kate, start us off with rash.
Yeah, sure. So lucky for all of us, Mark is a regular reader of the journal Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy, which is the source of the article I have this week. Since I had never heard of it, I had to Google it. I know everyone listening will be interested to hear that it was founded by a woman scientist, Gladys Lounsbury Hobby, who was instrumental in taking penicillin from being like mold in a petri dish to being tablets and infusions available to human beings. Anyways, it has been believed, largely based on older studies of ampicillin, that all aminopenicillins like amoxicillin are very likely to cause a rash in kids with infectious mononucleosis and should therefore be avoided. This belief has been reinforced over and over and over again on every single high stakes exam that we take, starting with step one, carrying on throughout training. It still comes up. But recent studies have found that there are actually lower rates of rash with amoxicillin and have also found that other kinds of antibiotics may trigger a rash in kids with mono. So this study was a retrospective cohort from China, identified a little more than 870 kids who were hospitalized for mono at one of 14 different hospitals. It is worth noting that the criteria for being hospitalized and then for staying in the hospital are almost certainly different between Chinese hospitals and hospitals in the U.S. The length of stay for kids in the study was between 7 and 14 days, and criteria for hospitalization wasn't exactly clear. So in this study, kids with a history of drug allergy or who received any kind of systemic steroid were excluded. That left them with a little more than 670. 71% of them, 550 plus, received an antibiotic, including 49 who received amoxicillin. The study does not detail the indications for this incredibly high rate of antibiotic prescription for what is known to be a viral infection. Most of the kids, about 80%, were 6 years or younger. 61% in the study were male. The others did a regression analysis to look for potential confounding by age and sex. Overall, about 12% of the kids had any kind of rash, including 13% of those who received any kind of antibiotic, and about 9.3% of those who didn't. So rashes were more common in the group who got antibiotics. The others attempted to determine whether the rash was antibiotic-based or caused by something else. They concluded that about 46% of the rashes were antibiotic-associated, and that was a little bit their own definition. Only two of those 43 kids who were in that 92 who had an antibiotic-associated rash took amoxicillin. So only about 4% of the kids who got amoxicillin had any kind of antibiotic-associated rash. That's compared with 8.2% of the kids who got any kind of different antibiotic and also had a rash. The p-value there turned out to not be significant. It's interesting to say that older kids who are between the ages of 12 and 18 were more likely to have a rash associated with their antibiotic than younger kids. Those were in the 0 to 6-year-old group. limitations of the study, in addition to the ones that I've already mentioned, included, again, only kids who are hospitalized, so a very small proportion, hopefully, of kids who have mono. And again, the subjective nature of deciding which were the rashes involved, antibiotic associated or not. So again, bottom line here, this is yet another study that suggests amoxicillin. Again, I want to reinforce, essentially never indicated for the treatment of mono, may not be the pathognomonic rash generating antibiotic the US MLE has led us to think. Henry.
Yeah, well, thank you for the historical perspective on the journal. That's always something of interest to me at many levels, but it also kind of triggered how did this come about? There was probably some observation that a kid given amoxicillin for clinical diagnosis, perhaps, of strep, when in fact what they had was mono. But how did this myth get perpetuated, if it's a myth? And so, you know, I can think about all of the various cognitive biases that might play into that, as well as the potential just chance, you know, occurrence between an antibiotic-associated rash that had nothing to do with the mononucleosis. So I don't know what to make of this other than just as you point out, if you got a kid with mono, the testing is so easy, you don't really need to give anything.
Yeah, I can answer that one sadly for you because I was so deep in this rabbit hole that I actually went and looked at. I asked the same question, like what on earth made them think that this was associated in the first place? So some of the very early studies of the aminoglycosides actually did, not aminoglycosides, sorry, aminopenicillins, showed like a 70 to 80% or higher rate of rash when given to kids with mono. So that was like back in the 50s. So that's where it came from. There was some, you know, historical basis to it. And what went wrong in those studies, I couldn't tell you. But yeah, I've been in that rabbit hole. You don't have to go there yourself.
Thank you.
It sounds like an academic endeavor. You can go ahead and resurrect all those.
I was supposed to be doing something else.
All of those ancient articles, you'll have to get them out of PubMed, I'm sure, out of the library. You know what this reminds me of? Very first day of medical school, I still remember this. I don't know, this is almost the only thing I remember is that we had a lecture by a fairly prominent doc in the medical school where I went to who said, 50% of what you learn in medical school is going to be found to be wrong. We just don't know what 50%. And how often have we been taught that and also, you know, perhaps passed on the teaching of this, what seemed to be a slam dunk, you know, association, which obviously turns out not to be.
Yes, vitamin E, hormone replacement therapy for everyone, all, et cetera, et cetera. I did want to say, you know, you mentioned about the hospitalization, and I think this was a Chinese study, and I think that the criteria for what gets you hospitalized and what they call a hospital are quite different from the U.S. in particular, where we actually have fewer hospital beds than almost any country in the world per capita basis. Because we do so much, we're so incentivized to get people out of the hospital to make more money. And so if you look at Europe and certainly Asia, there are a lot more hospital beds. So I think that's maybe part of it. It's pretty easy to get hospitalized over there. All right, Gary, you got a quiz for us.
I do. This is hot off the press.
You're going to have to pronounce that drug name too.
I've been practicing, just to be clear. So the oral GLP-1 agonist, orforglipron, that just rolled right off my tongue.
Yeah,
orforglipron, taken for 36 weeks for weight loss. And we'll talk about this as I get to the answer to this. And by the way, more than one answer might be correct. So is it no better than placebo for weight loss? Is it associated with a 3% greater loss of weight than placebo? Associated with a 10% greater loss of weight in up to 75% of participants? And is associated with adverse GI side effects. More than one answer, as I mentioned, might be correct. Stay tuned.
Thanks, Gary. Henry, it's your turn to talk about hearing aids.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about this drug, though. I think you need to pronounce it with a Jersey accent.
And what would that sound like?
Forget about it. So this next study asks whether hearing aids improve cognition in the elderly. It got all kinds of attention, and even though this has not actually yet been printed, it's been published online, I decided to include it. And frankly, even before all of the traffic mayhem, I was kind of pissy and snarky about this study, in part because of the kind of attention that it received. So first of all, This was a randomized trial that received government funding. And why they recruited participants from two different groups, I don't know. But they recruited from a cohort study called the ARIC study, Atherosclerosis Risk in Community Study, which had been going on since the mid-1980s. And the participants basically had about a decade worth of participation in this study that included many things, including neurocognitive testing. And then they had another group of individuals who just came from the community, a de novo group. So very, very different individuals. They did a stratified randomized trial, stratified at many levels, including among the participants, and they were randomized to hearing aids or no hearing aids. Everybody got time with an audiologist or a health educator for a number of sessions during the study period. At the end of 3 years, they only had 10% loss to follow-up. Not bad. What did they find? Well, when they looked at all of the data, there was no difference in global cognitive change between the two interventions. Now, they didn't like this so much, and so they decided to play a little fast and loose and said, but you know, if you only look at that ARIC group, that cohort group that were at high risk for atherosclerotic disease, that group of individuals had a slight improvement in their cognition compared with the controls. Now, there's lots of potential reasons for this. Random variation, there was some participation bias in that the ARIC participants were 5% more likely to participate in the study, whereas the de novo group were 5% less likely to participate. Oh, by the way, if the net effect is no difference and you've got one subgroup that is better, guess what? That means the other group got worse. Now, they said that there was not statistically significant, but that just doesn't make sense then, right? So, oh, by the way, they also, without providing any data, they said, you know, there really wasn't a lot of adverse events. And they said that they monitored specifically for otitis externa, cerumen impaction, ear foreign bodies, and death. Now, I got to tell you, that's the first time I've ever seen death clustered with those other outcomes. Overall, you know, use hearing aids to improve hearing and communication and quality of life. I'm not sure I'm ready to buy that even in a high-risk group of individuals that this is likely to really improve cognition. Mark?
I actually agree with you, Henry. And, you know, having had cerumen impaction, having these weird ear canals that fill with wax all the time, much better than death. Even though I don't like it, much better than death. Highly preferable. So I can vouch for that. Well, I haven't experienced the latter, but, you know, I'm assuming it's better. No, I agree. And I think it's great that, you know, you're critical of these subgroup analyses, the sort of postdoc subgroup analyses, because you can bet, I bet they didn't pre-specify that or power it for that or do anything. And so, you know, sometimes things just don't work. Kate?
I'm confused by it. So they took people who had hearing loss substantial enough to require hearing aids and they randomized them to not giving them hearing aids?
Yep.
I didn't realize that we could do that. That doesn't seem like the right thing to do.
Well, they got some other interventions designed to try to improve their health.
But that could be anything.
Yep.
I guess that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And did they get hearing aids in the end?
Yeah.
Well, that's 3 years later, though. Just doesn't seem like...
That's a lot of movie dialogue missed.
That's a lot of, I mean...
Annoying your spouse, yeah.
And everybody else around you, not being able to communicate with you. I guess I would have some ethical concerns with that one. I mean, that's a standard, possibly after glasses, one of the more common, you know, accommodations that we make.
Well, but maybe, you know, I assume they would have had to ask the patients, would you be okay not having hearing aids, even though you have some hearing loss? And
right,
that's how they got into the study.
When it's a brand new, you know, accommodation on offer, you don't know what you're missing.
Yeah,
I think
a lot of people, there are a lot of people out there that have hearing loss and don't wear hearing aids because they don't want to. So
but that seems different. I mean, that's...
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
So a number of years ago, I reviewed the contributions, at least the associated contributions to dementia, and I was surprised that one of the greatest contributions to dementia in terms of, you know, the cohort studies was hearing loss. And I was really hoping the study was going to be like much, much more positive. But I mean, in some ways, you know, is it almost too little too late? How old were these patients over the age of 70? And so I'm not quite ready to throw out the hypothesis, even though there is an association that maybe intervention might be positive because, you know, they had, as you pointed out, they had a fairly select group of patients here and the like. So I do think that there's possibly something to this. Maybe just the study did not look at it through the correct lens.
All right. We'll leave it at that. And let's see here. It is my turn, and I'm going to talk about stem cell injections for knee osteoarthritis. This was by Kim et al. In American Journal of Sports Medicine 2023, volume 51, page 2243. And the question they asked was, are adipose-derived stem cell injections effective in adults with moderate degenerative joint disease of the knee? And so this was a double-blinded randomized trial set in Korea, and they enrolled adults who had radiographically confirmed DJD of the knee. They all had to have pain levels of at least 50 out of 100, where 100 is excruciating, presumably, and zero is no pain at all. They also all had to have some impaired function on the WOMAC index from Western Ontario. I think it's something like that. So it's a standard functional measure for arthritis studies. So the authors report that the minimum clinically important difference for these scores are 14 and 9 points. And I agree with those. On a 100-point scale, 14 points, I think, is a reasonable cutoff for what a patient is likely to notice instead of just a 2-point difference that we can notice with statistics that a patient would actually experience. So they randomized just over 260 patients to ultrasound-guided injections of autologous adipose-derived stem cells, or saline. They were performed by a physician who wasn't part of the study. These stem cells had been cultured for 3 weeks before injection, something that is actually currently not allowed in the U.S. I didn't know that. I think Henry might have written this one up, and I will find out more about that. They evaluated changes in the VAS, the visual analog scale, and the WOMAC, only for the 252 patients who completed 6 months of follow-up, but that's almost everybody, so that's okay. After 6 months, both groups had clinically meaningful improvements in pain, but the net difference between placebo and stem cells, which was about 10 points, is somewhat less than that MCID of 14. So statistically significant, probably not clinically very meaningful. In the same way, both groups' function scores, the WOMAC scores improved, but the net difference was only 5 points, which is less than the MCID of 9. And, you know, a more relevant outcome is responders. So more patients who received stem cell injections had clinically meaningful improvements in pain scores, 68 versus 53%. So the number needed to treat is about 7. And in the WOMAC score, the number needed to treat for a significant improvement in function was 4. So some people are getting a pretty significant benefit, but probably quite a few aren't. And on average, the overall benefit was modest. Slightly more than a third in each group had some adverse events, but not that different between groups. So bottom line in this study, after 6 months, adults with moderate DJD of the knee who got stem cell injections were more likely to experience clinically meaningful improvements in pain and function than those who got saline injections. You going to line up for your saline for your injection, Gary?
Yeah, I'm going to say stem cells fascinate me. And the question I ask is, when somebody's given a stem cell transplant for hematological problems, how does the stem cell know it has to turn into a hematopoietic cell? It does. We know it flat out works. It just sets up shop, does what it does, people's counts improve, and they go on with life. Presumably in this situation, is it a similar analogy where you give these adipose-derived stem cells into the knee joint and they're supposed to turn into cartilage? And if that's the case, I mean, is 6 months long enough? I mean, you know, because this was only a 6-month study as well. So, I mean, there's some noise here to suggest that it might be beneficial. I can't imagine the cost of this, harvesting them, culturing them, you know, injecting them, following up with them.
I got quoted about $800 because insurance won't cover it. I think that's what the orthopedic practice quoted. Which didn't seem like very much to me.
Did you get offered that?
They offered it to me, but at that point, this is one of the reasons we picked this study was because it is one of the first studies to show any benefit of stem cell injections. Right. Pretty much every other study has been negative. And so this one, you know, then you have to ask, if we have 20 studies that are negative and one's positive, maybe it's just sort of random chance. But Kate?
Yeah, you know how much I love a non-operative orthopedic or sports medicine study, so I'll yield my time to Henry, who I think is bursting with things to say about this one.
No, I'm not bursting with things to say about it. This actually came up in our courses last year, that there was a question about use of stem cells. And I did find a systematic review at the time that most of the studies were flawed, but showing some degree of benefit. And many of them, kind of like the platelet-rich plasma studies, have serious flaws. The other part that's fascinating here is the regulatory climate in the U.S. The issues around embryonic stem cells have kind of bled over into all other stem cell sources as well. And so that, I think, is part of the basis for that three-week incubation period. So, so it may be a while before the regulatory climate changes with here in the U.S.
Bottom line, it was a modest benefit. The NNT of 7 for pain is, you know, maybe meaningful, but, you know, I'm still a bit lukewarm on it. I'm going to go ahead with my knee replacement instead of betting on stem cells. All right, Gary, you're going to tell us about non-pharmacologic ways to prevent diabetes.
Yeah, this is a study that has been shown to be effective over and over and over again. Not the study, but the actual principle. So first of all, the background, 37 million people in the U.S. have diabetes, obviously almost all of them with type 2, and then 1 in 3 have prediabetes. So obviously everybody knows that this is a big, big problem. And the question that these authors asked, which was published in Diabetes Care earlier this year, are healthful behaviors, which I'll define in a minute, associated with a lower likelihood of developing type 2 diabetes? They didn't look at clinical outcomes like amputations and the like, just did they go on from either not diabetic or pre-diabetic into type 2 diabetes. They identified 30 cohort comparisons, 1.6 million persons, of which about 5% ultimately developed diabetes. And the research for these cohort studies had to involve tracking the relationship. They said at least three variables. They looked at five specific variables. Number one, what was the association for developing diabetes if you had a BMI less than 30? Number two, a healthy diet, basically more fresh food and less processed food. Number three was regular exercise. They defined as greater than 30 minutes twice a week. Don't smoke and drink light alcohol. And they defined the alcohol consumption in grams. So I had to look this up. So 30 grams of alcohol, somewhere between 1 and 1.5 glasses of wine. So that's what 30 grams is. So what they did is they compared the people with the best scores versus the people with the worst scores. And this, the actual risk reduction was pretty dramatic. Now, they said adhering to at least three of these five was associated with an 80% lower risk of type 2 diabetes when you compared the cohorts and the highest versus the lowest scores. And then when you looked at, I think, all five of them, it was 85 or 90% decrease in the risk of developing diabetes. Didn't seem to be any difference by gender. And then it seemed to have the greatest impact on people younger than the age of 50. Now, this is very similar to the ACC-AHA's Life Simple 7. So they have been talking about Life Simple 7 for a number of years here. Don't smoke, best you can, keep your weight under control, be active, eat better. And they also include some cardiovascular features as well. So this study, including the features in the Life Simple study, Life Simple 7, have actually shown improved outcomes. The Life Simple 7 studies, which were published basically in the late 2010s and 2020, showed an improvement in mortality. So even though they didn't look at clinical outcomes here, obviously the association between healthful behaviors and decreased development of diabetes is fairly robust.
Kate?
I can't think of anything more profound to say than duh. I guess I will say they updated Life Simple 7, which I always found insulting because if it was simple, everybody would do it, to Life's Essential 8. And I think sleep was the thing they added.
Oh, it might be.
Yeah, which I guess I appreciate that it's no longer, they agree it's no longer simple.
Ooh, another one I can do. Good. I'm certainly not doing all 8.
when I talk to residents about this kind of stuff, or students, or particularly when I'm editing something for one of the journals, I actually say I almost don't care about the role of like lifestyle stuff on whatever disease condition we're talking about. You can write the paragraph for sure, because it's like the foundation of everything, but we all already know it. The thing that I'm now most interested in is, how do we do this? Like, how do we, what's the script for talking to the patient? What's the evidence behind, you know, like, how do I, as a family physician, how do we, as primary care docs, how do we have these conversations that actually, so we know this evidence really well for smoking, and we know far less about it for essentially all of these other lifestyle changes. So that's what I really want to know now, is how do we get there? It's clearly not enough to tell people, like, you know, eat right and exercise. That's kind of the
When I was on the task force, we were addressing, this is one of the recommendations, right? You know, healthy lifestyle choices and counseling regarding healthy lifestyle. And when you look at the data, the interventional studies, the randomized trials, short interventions, basically anything less than 2 hours, has very modest impact. They have to be sustained, and they have to be for at least two, and ideally, you know, 20, 30 hours. And so I think that's what Medicare will actually pay for now, is it has, but it has to be a substantial intervention. It can't just be a very brief counseling, because those don't work. Henry?
Yeah, so I think the other important messages here is that, first of all, the younger participants had the greatest effect. So starting younger, and that's kind of makes a lot of sense. The other piece, and this plays off a little bit from Kate, as to what I would like to see more of, are effective strategies for overcoming barriers. Now, some of the barriers are within the individual, and some of them are structural. We know that people living in food deserts and in places where there's high violent crime, that going out and exercising, taking simple walks and things of that nature, are just really a big challenge. So I'd like to see more of those kinds of things.
Great point. Thank you. And we're going to close it out here in a few minutes. Gary's got the quiz answer about orforglipron.
Oh, your pronunciation just rolled off your tongue.
Va bene. Yes, I know.
You say it again, orforglipron.
No.
All right. So this was just published, I think, last week in the New England Journal. So our listeners know, of course, the GLP-1 agonists have just been exploding onto the scene for almost anything that ails you. But certainly this is about weight loss. So the only two FDA-approved agents are injectable. You got the semaglutide and the liraglutide. And the only other oral one that I'm aware of, there's probably other ones out now, oral semaglutide, which is a Rybelsus, is only approved for type 2 diabetes. So now they're starting to, you know, morph these oral agents into weight loss drugs. So this was published, as I mentioned, I think just last week in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's not yet available, probably will be. This is probably their FDA approval process. They had a small study, 272 participants. BMI was 37, but they did not have type 2 diabetes. So this was all about weight loss. And they went on placebo or four different doses of the drug. And the weight reduction of at least 10% at 36 weeks was kind of like their big outcome. They looked at it at 26 weeks or 24 weeks and 36 weeks. And what they found, that there was probably at least a 5 to 7 time fold increase in the number of patients who lost 10% by 36 weeks. So it was anywhere between about 50% and 75%, depending on the dose of the medication, versus about 10% in placebo. As very similar to the injectable GLP-1 agonists, GI side effects were indeed higher, about 4 to 5 times higher, with nausea, vomiting, and constipation. So the answer to this is three, or C, I can't remember if we did numbers or letters, is associated with a 10% or greater weight loss in up to 75% of the participants, and is associated with the higher rates of adverse GI side effects. Not a big surprise for either, but at least this is now looking at these oral medications for potential weight loss interventions.
Yeah, I think they're all, the drug companies are all trying to figure out ways to take their injectable molecule and make it oral, you know, because nobody wants injections. So interesting and good to know. So thank you, everybody, for listening today. We hope you enjoyed our discussion of these four poems. Check out EssentialEvidencePlus.com. Check out our newly updated and sparkly new website. Tell your friends about us and the podcast. We love getting a few more listeners, and we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.